Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Chaos in Haiti. Surveying the earthquake damage in his country yesterday, Haiti's president wondered out loud where he would find a place to sleep. Meanwhile, the U.S. president said help is on the way.
Search and rescue teams from Florida, Virginia, and California will arrive throughout today and tomorrow. And more rescue and medical equipment and emergency personnel are being prepared.
Haitians wait for aid and search for shelter and loved ones in the wreckage. Haiti holds on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Thursday, January 14th, and I don't know if you saw that story. Rene Préval surveying the wreckage, and the president of Haiti yesterday saying his two houses were destroyed. He didn't even know where he was going to sleep. It reminded me of that 1953 lullaby sung by Haitian singer Lolita Cuevas. In 1953, it's a Smithsonian recording.
They made some incredible recordings.
Well,
but
the takeaway is, how long can Haiti hold on, really?
And I would hope that they can hold on through at least one more disaster. Let's get right to the top stories. A new day of misery dawns in Port-au-Prince. For thousands, it was another night spent sleeping outside amid the ruins and cries for help. The death toll remains unknown, but everyone seems to agree it's at least in the tens of thousands. Because of a lack of heavy equipment, the search for survivors continues by hand at a frantic pace.
We need more people down here! We need more people down here!
But above the cries of sadness, many are gathering in public squares or empty streets or in churches, trying to make sense of the madness around them.
That's a church service at the Notre Dame de Haiti Church of Haitian immigrants thinking about their compatriots back home. The United States has taken the lead in launching a massive response. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spoke with NBC News.
This is incredibly complex work. We have some of the best people in the world from the United States down there, and we're just going to do everything we can to be helpful.
And the pace of relief efforts seems to be picking up. A Chinese plane arrived this morning. 10 tons of supplies and a 60-member earthquake relief team was on that shipment. And a U.S. aircraft carrier with supplies and 2,000 Marines is expected to arrive this afternoon. Joining us now is Millery Polonais, a professor of American Studies at New York University. He's a Haitian scholar. And I'm wondering, what is Haiti's political response in a disaster like this? People are holding on, waiting for help. But does the Haitian government rise to the occasion in a disaster like this, or do people at least run the risk of becoming more cynical and bitter about their predicament?
It's really, really two Haitis going on here. There's
interesting.
Haiti the state and Haiti the nation. Historically, Haiti the state has never been really an institution that has helped out the masses. It's always been very difficult for it because of, you know, economic issues and financial issues, things of that nature.
Well, the dual personality of Haiti is what we want to explore all morning with you, Millery. Stay with us, and we'll be back in just a moment. If you want to donate, by the way, to the massive relief effort in Haiti, you can go to our website, thetakeaway.org.
Taking a look at markets, Asian markets were mixed. European indices up. Futures are flat, though. The Dow will start at 10,680, the S&P at 1,145, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,307.
You're going to want to stay tuned. Later this hour, we're going to take a look at low-cost, low-tech innovations that are going to help Haiti right now. Fuel that comes from sugarcane, straws that filter water and are easy to maintain. And in the wake of Haiti's devastating earthquake, we're asking our listeners, what's the responsibility of the world's richest nation?
We need to come together and help this country as much as we can. It seems that the Red Cross seems to be able to respond to tragedies much more quickly than any other country. So what we probably need to do is support them.
Who has the expertise? Should the U.S. government shoulder the financial burden, or should relief be left to relief organizations? You know how to reach us, 8778-MYTAKE, or email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're going to explore some of the challenges relief organizations are going to find on the ground in Haiti. That's in a minute. Good morning, everyone. We want to get you fully updated on what's going on in Haiti. The official death count is just beginning in that nation, and various estimates say tens of thousands of people may die when the final count is put together. There are even estimates as high as 100,000, but search teams and health assessment teams are looking and trying to figure out where the most damage is and where the people are most threatened. And of course, for people who are alive and survivors and people who are injured, time, as we are saying, is running out as the relief operation begins. Lucy Tondreau, you're a Haitian community advocate in Miami, Florida, joining us from Miami. When do you ship out for Haiti?
As soon as we have clearance. As a matter of fact, we were hoping to do so today, and unfortunately, we haven't gotten clearance yet. As soon as we have the clearance, I will be one of the few people that are able to go and help.
There's a real relief traffic jam there because the dropping-off point is Miami for so many people who are headed to Haiti. Let me give you a sense of what you're going to see when you finally arrive in Port-au-Prince. This is from the Miami Herald's Francis Robles reporting in Haiti for your local public radio station, WLRN. Listen to this.
I don't want to give the impression that every building in Port-au-Prince has collapsed. That's certainly not the case. You have a very busy, vibrant city with everybody running around. And then let's say you have a flap where there's 30 buildings. Three of them may have collapsed. And maybe there were 30 people in those three buildings. So that you have a trail of dead bodies scattered throughout the city. You might just be walking down the street, and then there are three or four bodies laid out with white sheets over them on the sidewalk.
So, Lucy Tondreau, it's a grim situation there, but hardly lifeless. What have you heard about what you expect to find?
Well, I know what I'm expecting to find, since each time there's a calamity in Haiti, I'm always there on the ground helping. It's the feeling of helplessness right here in South Florida that is the hardest part. We know what to expect. We want to put our grain of salt in order to help. And we know that from watching the news, the bodies are laying everywhere in Port-au-Prince. The buildings that have collapsed and mostly the people in despair, not knowing where to go, not able to find their loved ones, and it is heartbreaking.
Right. Well, you are with a medical response team leaving from Miami-Dade County as soon as there is clearance. As you say, Lucy Tondreau, stand by for us there in Miami. Millery Polonais, who's a professor of American Studies at New York University, we talked to you just at the top of the hour. That powerlessness that Lucy talks about, you know personally. You have family in Haiti who you still maybe have not heard from.
Yes, we our family has our cousin, unfortunately, who passed away, Azu, and we're looking for five other family members.
And, you know, when we were talking off air, and I was reminded of a very evocative soundbite I heard last night on a public radio program where you look at the sky, it's beautiful. You look down at the ground, it couldn't be more awful.
Yeah.
You said to me this morning, we're trying to figure out why Haiti.
Yeah.
That's a real feeling among Haitians. Explain. Help me to understand that.
Why Haiti? I mean, many Haitians take so much pride in their history, and the history goes back to the Haitian Revolution, obviously slavery, and obviously going as early as to the 20th century U.S. occupation of Haiti. So we think about all this stuff, and so we think about all the kind of obstacles that have been in our way in order to achieve and progress, and they've always been whether economic, natural disasters, something that is happening, political disarray.
And Lucy Tondreau, you know the history of Haiti as well as anyone. What makes things difficult in a relief operation? You've had a lot of experience.
Well, what makes things more difficult is the lack of infrastructure in Haiti, to lack of preparedness in Haiti also, and the fact that the people of Haiti have never been able to count on their government, in order to look for help. That's why everybody's looking into the international community to come and seek help. The people of Haiti, after the four hurricanes that hit Haiti back-to-back, they have that potentiality to rise back whenever there is sadness in the country. And it is difficult for us here in the United States to understand people with nothing are able to live and be happy on a daily basis. So it is very difficult for us here, not being able to get in touch with loved ones, not knowing exactly what's going on. Are they okay? There's no communication. We were not able to get through Haiti for the past 2 days. Hopefully today we'll have some phone lines.
And, you know, it's, as you both point out, Lucy, you and Millery Polonais here in the studio, the Haitians are used to, have grown up with a history of not being able to rely on the government. That infrastructure, you have learned not to rely on. I'm wondering, and again, the U.S. is at the head, the tip of the spear of the relief operation here in this hemisphere. There will probably be more resources mobilized from the United States than anywhere else in the world, nevertheless. Does the U.S. have some complicity in that history where Haitians have learned not to trust their government, Millery Polonais?
Oh,
Lucy's agreeing with you, too. Lucy, yeah. Stay on the line.
Without a doubt. I mean, from going back to the Haitian Revolution to Haiti wasn't recognized once it achieved its independence until 1862 by the United States, going to 1915 to 1934, U.S. occupation, moving up to various issues in which the U.S. has propped up, supported various governments from Elie Lescot to Estime to Duvalier. So they've always been a part of Haitian foreign policy and have always had their hand in all of this.
So the relief operation, you know, not to get involved in a lot of U.S. bashing guilt, but nevertheless, I mean, we're a part of that history. We ought to be a part of the solution. 877-8-MY-TAKE or my take at thetakeaway.org. What do you believe is America's role in this hemisphere? Lucy Tondreau, before we go, why don't you take us out? You have some impressions?
Yes, I do. Not only the occupation of Haiti, but the army that was trained not to serve the people, but to kill people in Haiti. That was part of the heritage that we've got also after the occupation in 1934, after the United States left.
And each of these things means that the people have difficulty having faith in the very infrastructure that they must rely on now for aid. And, of course, the priority is to get clean drinking water to the people and aid and food in these periods when time is running out. Millery Polonais, you're going to stay with us. Thanks so much. Lucy Tondreau, good luck in Haiti. I hope you can ship out today.
Thank you so much.
Lucy Tondreau is a Haitian community advocate in Miami, Florida. And now at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on stories we're following.
The U.S. aircraft carrier USS Carl Vinson is expected to arrive off the coast of Haiti later today. We're also getting word that the Navy is sending an amphibious assault ship, the USS Bataan, that's been ordered to sail as soon as possible, carrying 2,000 Marines. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has cut short her visit to the Asia-Pacific region to deal with the crisis in Haiti. She said the death toll will be massive.
We know that there will be tens of thousands of casualties. We don't have any exact numbers now.
On the ground in Haiti, the crisis continues. Here's Haitian radio host Karel Pedre describing the scene to CBS via Skype.
I know there's a lot of people under the building collapse. A lot of traffic, people crying.
The United Nations has released $10 million from its emergency funds, even as UN peacekeepers on the island struggle with their own losses. The UN headquarters building collapsed, and at least 16 personnel are confirmed dead, with up to 150 still missing.
In other stories, President Obama is set to announce a new 10-year tax on the country's largest banks. Officials are calling it a financial crisis responsibility fee, an effort to cover a projected $117 billion shortfall in the Wall Street bailout fund. Today is the second day of hearings into the financial crisis. Attorney General Eric Holder is expected to tell the investigating panel that the Justice Department is using every tool at its disposal to fight the financial crimes that contributed to the meltdown. And Tulsa singer Teddy Pendergrass died yesterday after a difficult recovery from colon cancer surgery 8 months ago. Pendergrass, a popular artist in the 70s, was paralyzed from the waist down in a 1982 car crash. He was 59.
That's some of the stories that we're looking at this morning. Coming up, more updates from Haiti.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first news takeout refers to expatriate communities here in the United States, all over the U.S. There are communities and cities, New York is one of them, where Haitian Americans have particular interest in what's going on in their country. Miami is another one of those communities. Joshua Johnson is a reporter and host for WLRN in Miami. They're a partnership with the Miami Herald News. And one voice from the Miami Herald is heard this morning on WLRN, a special called Disaster in Haiti. Here's a clip.
I don't want to give the impression that every building in Port-au-Prince has collapsed. That's certainly not the case. you have a very busy, vibrant city with everybody running around. And then let's say you have a graph where there's 30 buildings, three of them may have collapsed. And maybe there were 30 people in those three buildings.
It's reporter Francis Robles joining us now. Joshua Johnson, anchor and reporter for WLRN, Miami Herald News, soon to be part of the Takeaway family. Joshua, good morning.
Yes, indeed. We start airing the Takeaway on February 1st, and we are very excited.
Well, that's great. That's not why we asked you to come on the program. What is the special relationship, though, between your station and the Haitian-American community there in Miami and your efforts to show what's going on in Haiti right now?
Well, what we're going to try and do today is at 11 a.m. we'll have an hour-long call-in program. This is totally the biggest story for us right now. It seems to be dominating the news nationally, but because it happened just a few hours away from us by plane, it's on everyone's minds. Everyone wants to know how they can help. It is starting to eclipse certain other aid drives. There's a local commuter rail system that was doing a food drive for local food pantries, and yesterday they generated 2,000 pounds of food because people are in giving mode. So South Florida is really ready to help out, and we're going to try and steer some of the donations today.
You know, and Joshua, we should remind people, it's not simply heartstrings that connect the community in Miami to the people in Haiti, just like here in New York City. There are remittances that go back and forth. Family members have all kinds of communications and links. These are in many ways lifelines, these communities in the United States connecting
literal
to
lifelines.
Haiti. Literal.
I mean, millions and millions of dollars go out of Miami to all of Latin America all year long, and without communications or, quite frankly, a safe place to store money, we're not really sure what the state of remittances is going to be. I'm going to try and flesh that out a little bit today, but, you know, there are people here who support Haiti in very literal ways and very tangible ways, and so there are real-life concerns just beyond people's heartstrings and worrying about their families.
Well, we were talking with some expatriates this morning on the Takeaway, and they were saying the remittances are shut down in their community and their attempts to send money to Haiti. How does the relief effort supplement what's now down?
Well, the good news is that South Florida is very tangible in the relief effort. We may not be able to send money, but we are sending a lot of people. The University of Miami has an operation there through their Miller School of Medicine. They've already started going back and forth. There are relief trips that went from Fort Pierce, which is about 2 hours north of Miami. They're going back and forth. Miami-Dade Fire Rescue's Urban Search and Rescue Team is one of the best in the nation. They worked 9/11. They worked the storms in 2004, 2005, earthquakes, so they're very experienced in this. 80 people flew out last night from Miami
Wow.
International to go to Haiti. So we may not be able to get money there, but we are literally going. We're sending tons and tons of people back and forth to South Florida. So we are still helping in a very tangible way.
Well, the institutions in Miami mobilized to help the people of Haiti. And one of those institutions, of course, is WLRN Miami Herald News. Joshua Johnson is a reporter and host of a special airing this morning in Miami called Disaster in Haiti. Joshua Johnson, thanks so much.
In another takeout on business, the leaders of four big Wall Street banks were called to Capitol Hill to testify before the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. After hours of questioning, they seem to take very little responsibility for the human error that contributed to the crisis.
Looking back on this now, would you look back on some of the financings as negligent or improper?
In the context of the world that we were in, I think those were very typical behaviors.
That's Lloyd Blankfein, the head of Goldman Sachs, saying those were typical behaviors that led to the crisis. Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Why does that make me uneasy?
Morning, Celeste. Well, if you listened carefully, he did not answer the question.
No.
The question was, were those negligent behaviors? And he did not say if they were negligent or not. He said they were typical. And that is what you're hearing among the survivors of this crisis. The leaders of these banks, the ones that did not fail, the ones that are still here, are saying, look, this was what the world was like. This is what we were doing. This is what everyone was doing. And we did it less because we survived. The ones who really did it badly failed. And that's how they answer the
questions.
So
it's the old, I was speeding officer because everybody else was going the same rate of speed.
That is the tone. Now, there's going to be a lot more hearings from this commission. Their goal is to get to the bottom of the financial crisis. They have a year to do it. The head of the commission put it yesterday. He said that we are a proxy for the American people, their eyes, their ears, and possibly also their voice. So they're taking this seriously to dig in and figure out what went wrong.
So had the answers from the bankers changed, or maybe the questions from the lawmakers?
What I feel is different, you know, a year ago, there was a hearing in Washington with the 8 leaders of the biggest banks that took the bailout, and I covered that. And that hearing was all about asking them for advice. How do we end this crisis? How do we keep you alive? How do we stabilize the markets? And there was a real shift in tone. Now that the markets are stabilized, you are seeing a lot more tarn feathering and a lot more hard questions, in part, I think, because leaders in Washington think they can question people now because they've stabilized the system, and also in part because, as a public, we've all learned more in the past year about what really happened, and I think we'll learn even more over the next year. I know that we're planning to continue deep reporting on what caused this.
Louis Story is a finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times. Coming up, we're going to take an in-depth look at the federal terror response under President Obama's first year with journalist Peter Baker. And all day we're asking you, what is the responsibility of the world's richest nation in response to the earthquake that rocked Haiti? Should America be shouldering the financial burden for the relief effort? Or should we leave that in the hands of international relief organizations? What is your take? Are we at least responsible for what's gone on in Haiti? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can also post a comment at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headley, joined here by John Hockenberry. Coming up, President Bush felt it in his gut. President Obama thinks it in his head. Changing policies on terror. We're going to talk about that in a moment with journalist Peter Baker. But first, let's take a look at top stories at 30 minutes after the hour.
Well, market check first. Asian markets mixed. European indices up. Futures are up right now. The Dow gets underway at 10,680, and the S&P opens at 1,145, and the NASDAQ begins at 2307. We shift now to reporting on Haiti. Tamar Hahn is regional communications officer for UNICEF, who joins us from the Dominican Republic right now. Tamar, thanks so much for being with us.
Yes, hi, how are you?
Now, there's a hub operation that's beginning to assemble there in the Dominican Republic. First of all, what is UNICEF's top priority right now?
Our top priority is children and to assist them in any way possible together with their families. So we are setting up operations in the border town of Jemani, which is about 3 hours from the capital here of Santo Domingo and about an hour and a half by land from Port-au-Prince. And what is happening there is that we're seeing all the UN agencies coalescing to put together a response for Haiti. For us, the main priority for children is the issue of basic medical care to begin with. As you know, the medical facilities in Haiti right now are not operational. So we are receiving children in a hospital locally, and we're providing also water and sanitation, nutrition and protection services.
So there is an air link now from Port-au-Prince to where you are in the Dominican Republic to serve children who need trauma care?
No, it's not air link. It's just people trickling through the border from Haiti into the Dominican Republic are receiving care. And at the same time, the whole UN family, as well as other organizations, are basically setting up camp in this town to provide assistance and to drive supplies into Haiti.
Well, Tamar Hahn, we wish you the best, and we certainly want to say our hearts go out to all of the sacrifices that the UN workers have made already in the devastation in Haiti, the peacekeeping operation, and the losses that you've already received. Tamar Hahn is regional communications officer for UNICEF in the Dominican Republic right now, setting up for medical assistance for Haitian children. Thanks so much.
After the attempt to explode a bomb on an American plane on Christmas Day, how and when President Obama became a focus in the storm of media coverage that followed it, the New York Times Washington correspondent Peter Baker fills out those headlines for us. He has an in-depth look at Obama's approach to terrorism as opposed to that of the administration that came before him. It's in this week's New York Times Magazine. It's the cover story called, tellingly, Obama's War Over Terror. Peter Baker joins us now. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. How are you?
So you talk in the article a lot about the difference in responses between the Bush administration to terrorism and the Obama administration. And you start, one of the places that you start is with the response to the Christmas Day bombing. Can you tell me what you learned from that?
Well, you saw that President Obama was reluctant to rush out to the cameras after the attempted bombing on Christmas Day. His style is to wait for more information, to think about things before, you know, giving it what he would worry would be a too abrupt reaction. But even then, that causes a political problem for him. His very deliberation, which is a relief to many people who were tired of what they saw as sort of swaggering President Bush, strikes others as a sign that he doesn't really take the issue as seriously as he ought to. That's the source of criticism from former Vice President Cheney, as an example. But, you know, President Obama obviously has taken terrorism seriously. He just has a different approach than President Bush's. A lot of the policies are still pretty much the same. There's not a huge difference in policy, at least from the second term of President Bush to the new Obama administration. But the tone is different. The language is different. The way he approaches it as a conception is different.
You know, let's talk a little bit about the similarities first. One of the things that I found interesting was that you said Barack Obama knows the chances are good that there will be a successful attack on the United States sometime during his tenure. And he also knows that if he drastically changed policies from the Bush times of the Bush administration, that that's what people would point to.
Right, that's exactly right. And a lot of the things that he found on his desk at the Oval Office when he came in almost a year ago, he is more or less kept. You know, by the time that President Bush left office, some of the harsher and more controversial elements of his counterterrorism strategy had already been moderated, either because of pressure from the Supreme Court or Congress or news media disclosures. So what President Obama inherited was a different much more consensus approach than the first term President Bush. For instance, President Obama has kept the military commissions. Now, he's added some more procedural safeguards, but he's kept those. He's kept the national security letters. He's kept the power of rendition. He has argued for some of the same state secrets cases that President Bush had argued for. And he's also going to continue to keep at least several dozen terrorist suspects locked up without trial or charges. You know, there are some important differences. He's going to bring Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-described mastermind of 9/11, to New York for trial in a civilian court. But largely, President Obama has kept going the same direction and accelerated the same evolution that was already going on in the last 2 years of the Bush administration.
But you do point to a difference in that you see, say, Obama sees this as a war with al-Qaeda, not a war on terror.
Right. He had a different sort of rhetorical approach and a different tone than the last administration. He feels that war on terror, first of all, terror to him is a tactic, not an enemy. He calls it a war on al-Qaeda. But that does lend itself to the criticism that you hear a lot from Republicans, that means he doesn't think he's at war, that he is considering this to be a law enforcement problem rather than, you know, a great confrontation. He would argue that's not the case. He would argue that the point is to make clear that America is at war with a small group of extremists rather than with the larger Muslim world, which is the way a lot of Muslims around the world had perceived it in the last few years.
Well, Peter Baker, let me just pose this question to you then. As Obama likes to say, let's be clear. Because Obama seems to be holding the tools of rendition, of possible domestic surveillance, do you think he's more inclined to pursue those tactics in his war on al-Qaeda or more inclined to resist using them than President Bush?
Well, the argument would be is that he maintains that power but will use it more wisely, more judiciously, less you know, less radically, perhaps, in the previous administration. That would be the argument. You know, what his critics on the left would say is that is a problem because, you know, the inherent power in the executive should not be based on who is the executive. It should be based on what we think are the proper roles of each part of government in terms of its power over its own citizenry.
One of the things that also struck me was you talked about how Obama feels that the Bush strategy elevated the terrorists, gave them more power than they deserved, and it allowed them, you said, to change American society without their ever carrying out a single successful attack. What does Obama mean with that?
Well, I mean, you know, let's face it, you know, even if the underwear bomber had succeeded, that he would have killed perhaps 300 people. That's a terrible, terrible tragedy. But there are something like 14,000 murders in this country every year. So they have a disproportionate impact with the President Obama wants to find a way to keep from making them the singular threat to the nation equivalent to the Nazis or communism during the Cold War.
Peter Baker is the White House correspondent for the New York Times, joining us this morning. That article is the cover story for this week's New York Times Magazine. We are talking about Haiti all morning, and we're asking you, what is the responsibility of the world's richest nation to a catastrophe in the world's poorest nation? Let us know, should the United States shoulder the relief burden? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And we turn now back to the situation in Haiti. And joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Cameron Sinclair, Executive Director and co-founder of the organization Architecture for Humanity. Good morning, Cameron.
Good morning, guys. How
and,
are you?
Great. And we've been talking about the need for clean drinking water and medical care in the early going in Haiti in the aftermath of the earthquake this week. But there's also a need for shelter, and you've dispatched, I gather, a ground team of your sort of SWAT team architects to begin the task of rebuilding Haiti and Port-au-Prince. Describe, first of all, why Haiti needs architects right now and what architecture can do for humanity in a disaster.
Well, you know, we were recently in Haiti just a few months ago, ironically, to do a couple of buildings around post-disaster recovery. And while we were there, we were kind of horrified by the quality of construction, or so to speak, the lack of construction, and the need for kind of sound and strong buildings. And, you know, now more than ever, we need to look at the not just the recovery process, but the full reconstruction process, and how do you build housing stock and community structures that are not only for the next 5-10 years, but to mitigate for future disasters.
How do you involve the community in that process so that this kind of thing doesn't happen again in the rebuilding process?
Well, one of the big mistakes in the reconstruction process is kind of a top-down solution, which is you kind of fly in a team, you have a solution, you start implementing that solution without the community involvement. Architecture for Humanity is really a community-led reconstruction process where the families and the community are part of the design process and construction process as we go forward. Because without the buy-in and the empowerment of the community, there's no ownership. So it's vital to have their involvement.
And you're focused on schools and large-scale structures as much as housing at this point. Is it really true that part of your motto is you go where Anderson Cooper of CNN doesn't go?
Sort of. You know, part of that is that we tend to direct our services where communities have really been overlooked, both by governmental and international government agencies. So certainly after Hurricane Katrina, we were in the kind of towns and villages that were really hit by Katrina head-on and didn't get the attention of the media. So we tend to find those communities that have been overlooked and find ways we can help them best.
What are the challenges you're facing right now before we go?
There's a lack of materials, there's going to be a lack of construction availability, and quite frankly, within about 3 to 4 weeks, the world's eyes are going to turn away from Haiti, and we're going to forget the sort of damage and the long-term need for solutions. And what happens is funding dries up, and anything you raised in the first few weeks is really what you've got to play with in terms of reconstruction. So it's raising a large amount of money very quickly so that we can look at not just the first month, but the first year and the first 5 years of the rebuilding process.
And that's the mission of Architecture for Humanity, focusing now on the rebuilding effort and creating a sustainable community that involves people in Haiti in that rebuilding effort. Cameron Sinclair, Executive Director of Architecture for Humanity. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, some sophisticated low-tech solutions in high-risk conflict zones like Haiti. It may be just the solution for the earthquake relief. We're going to talk to a couple of experts on that. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Before we get to Haiti, we want you to know a breaking story, some economic news just out. Retail sales dropped 0.3% in December. For all of 2009, they plunged by a record amount. In labor, new claims for unemployment insurance rose more than expected, while continuing claims have dropped. And so we've heard this morning back to Haiti about the U.S. response to the disaster, but we want to catch you up on the response from many other countries. An aid flight from China arrived in Haiti this morning. Food, medical aid, 60-man relief team was on that flight, 10 tons of food. China says its team is fully experienced after dealing with China's own earthquake, you'll recall, in 2008, which killed nearly 100,000 people. Australia has sent $10 million in assistance. Japan will provide $5 million. The WHO says it has sent specialists to help clear Haiti's capital city of corpses. And the Israeli army has sent 2 plane loads of rescue staff and equipment to set up a field hospital that can serve 500 people a day.
In other news, Google's announcement that it may pull out of China has sparked a lot of speculation of the future of an open internet, but we've had little response from the Chinese government until today. Earlier this morning, I spoke with BBC's Shanghai correspondent, Chris Hogg. I asked him what China was saying about Google.
Well, we had a foreign ministry spokeswoman asked 7 times about Google at her regular weekly briefing. I would say her response was pretty predictable. She said that China opposed any form of cyber attack, such as computer hacking, so rejecting the suggestion that China's government was responsible for the attack on Google. And she said the internet was open in China and China wanted to develop it, was making efforts to create a favorable environment for that, and that any internet firm was welcome to do business in the country as long as it followed the law.
Well, Google has decided to pull out of China. Is there room for negotiation here? Could Google change its mind if China says the right things?
Well, let's be clear. Google has said that it will stop self-censoring the internet searches. Now, if China doesn't agree to that, then it will pull out. But they haven't even sat down yet and had the face-to-face meeting. So it's too early, really, to say exactly how this is going to go. But it's very difficult because some people here argue it's impossible for Google to leave China. The economic downsides of such a move would just be too large. But it's equally going to be very hard for the government to relax its internet restrictions. So it's very hard to see how they'll resolve this.
Stuck between a rock and a hard place in China. That was my discussion with BBC's Shanghai correspondent Chris Hogg earlier this morning.
For our technology segment today, we want to talk about the sophisticated technology that can be brought to bear in a disaster relief situation and the surprising solutions that sometimes are more low-tech than high-tech. And to talk about this from both the beginnings of the supply chain to the places on the ground where people need the most help immediately, we've got Amy Banzart, who's a PhD candidate at MIT's D-Lab, which creates technologies for the developing world. She's on the line from Nicaragua. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
And Mark Belinsky joins us from here in New York. He's co-director of Digital Democracy. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Mark, let's talk about the beginning of the supply chain. When people want to get aid in, when they want to mobilize, often there's a kind of a glut, a traffic jam of communication backlogs where people have difficulty finding out information about loved ones, connecting with families inside countries. What are the high-tech tools that are available to help coordinate this effort and to keep gluts and backlogs from clogging the system?
Absolutely. There are so many people who want to come in and help, and it's important to make sure that there's not sort of too much information happening on the ground. And so we've been working on this solution called Ushahidi, which is a coordinated crisis map, where we get to pull in all the maps that are coming out on the ground, then overlaying it with the information as it comes out, locating where the buildings are that are collapsed, where there are people who still need help, and making this a place where people can text messages in so that we get response immediately as it's happening.
So it's a kind of a disaster, global disaster, frequently asked questions site that allows people to get answers there without clogging the system.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's pretty interesting. Have you been able to make something like that work here in this Haitian disaster?
Yeah, so we've been working on an install, and you can actually go see it right now. It's Haiti.ushahidi.com. And so we've been working around the clock, really drawing out the maps that can work right now. So there's not a sophisticated Google Maps system. You know, so it's really building that from scratch. It's taking brand new satellite photography and crafting out a new map, and then pushing in data as it emerges, emailing it in, transcribing from voicemails, and texting it in.
Oh, that's fascinating. Amy Banzhard in Nicaragua. Now, they're talking about, and Bill Clinton just said as recently as yesterday afternoon, that clean water is what's needed on the ground in Haiti right now. I'm thinking, okay, so we fly a bunch of water filtration systems, park them at the airport, and start handing out water. Is that the solution typically?
Frankly, I'm not an expert on disasters. I'm an expert on the technologies that are used sometimes in disasters and sometimes in everyday life. Haiti has a hard time, people have a hard time in Haiti getting access to clean water in the best of times. But certainly both the ability to test water and clean it very quickly and affordably and is ideal. I would not recommend putting stations just at the airport, but throughout the entire region where water can be cleaned, and I'm really not familiar with how bad the infrastructure is in terms of whether pumps and wells and that sort of thing are still available for people or if water is going to be even more of an issue.
Well, I understand that, but you actually have been a part of developing tools that actually bring the filtration system into the neighborhoods at the family level where people can actually do some of the filtration and testing themselves. Describe.
Absolutely. So we have one set of devices that allow you to test the water to determine if it's clean, and typically equipment for that costs between $800 and $1,200, and we have tests that cost about $10 as an upfront cost, and then individual tests cost about a few cents each, so orders of magnitude more affordable and available. Secondly, when you do the test, you need to keep the samples that you take of the water warm for 24 hours at human body temperature in order to determine bacterial growth rates, and you sniff before and during your D-Lab work has developed a test that requires no electricity, is very robust, and costs around $50 as opposed to the traditional test that durable battery-powered models that cost between $1,500 and $2,500. So again, we're talking about orders of magnitude of more affordable, simpler, more robust.
Is the strategy for relief operations and for the development of these kinds of technology in the developing world shifting towards more low-tech, low-cost solutions, or is there some resistance to adopting some of these ideas that you're describing?
Well, a lot of our innovations and efforts are so simple that people are taken aback. We're used to high-tech solutions here, and even within MIT, while D-Lab has a good name, people think, well, you know, these problems aren't actually hard because this solution is so simple, when in reality, there's incredible constraints on material resources because we're trying to get so affordable, so radically affordable, and therefore they're very sophisticated solutions, even though they come out looking very simple.
Interesting. Amy Banzhard is a PhD candidate at MIT's D-Lab, working now in Nicaragua to develop technologies for the developing world. Mark Belinsky is co-director of Digital Democracy. What lesson do you think we're likely to learn in Haiti, Mark, before we go?
I think we're really going to see how a coordinated effort from the international realm can really be used so that when communication technology gets up and running on the ground, it can instantly just start working.
It's a great hope. Mark Belinsky is co-director of Digital Democracy, talking about the advantages of using high-tech communication systems to reduce backlogs of information flow in places like Haiti, suffering from the aftermath of this earthquake. Thanks so much for joining us.
And today we're asking you all day long, what do you think is the responsibility of the world's richest nations in response to these earthquakes that rocked Haiti? One listener wrote on our website, thetakeaway.org, the Haitian people need the United States to help more than ever. Just a small portion of what we spend on wars could save the lives and futures of one of our closest neighbors in the hemisphere.
Bruce from Maine says maybe countries don't need to be involved here at all.
I think that the corporations from America, like a lot of the sporting goods manufacturers, which have made the millions of dollars of profit paying very little wages to people in Haiti, should be invested in rebuilding the country from the bottom up.
What's your take? What do you think? Let us know at 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. And you can always leave a comment at thetakeaway.org where you can follow live updates on the breaking news from Haiti. That's also where you can subscribe to podcasts. Here's your takeaway.
People of Haiti have never been able to count on the government
in order to look for help. That's why everybody's looking into the international community.
Lucy Tondreau is the Haitian community Haitian community advocate in Miami, Florida. I'm Celeste Headley.
Well, count on us. We're the Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.